From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, Academy Award-winning filmmaker William Friedkin reached the Hollywood stratosphere in the 1970s with such groundbreaking films as The French Connection and The Exorcist. But the success was not to last. As he writes in his new memoir, quote, "I was at the edge of a cliff and my demons were standing by waiting to push me off." Today, Friedkin is still directing films, including 2011's well-received Killer Joe, and he's developed a second career as an opera director. He'll join us in studio to discuss his memoir, The Friedkin Connection, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Chicago native William Friedkin joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. He began his career in television with an award-winning documentary, which led to work on such shows as The Bold Ones, The Alfred Hitchcock Hour, Twilight Zone, and many, many more. And he went on to direct a range of films, including the Oscar-winning French Connection and The Exorcist, as well as Boys in the Band, The Birthday Party, Cruising, Sorcerer, Killer Joe, To Live and Die in L.A., and he has also directed Puccini and a number of other operas. We're talking really about a 50-year career here, which he manages to give us a lot of narrative force in his new memoir. It's called The Friedkin Connection, 19 films, hundreds of television shows, quite a career and quite a life story, and glad to have you with us on Forum.
Great to be here, Michael.
Well, let's begin where you began. You began with regrets, saying, in effect, I'm immune to other people's feelings.
I was. I'm not now. But I went through a period of great hubris and arrogance. I was much too young to receive the kind of acclaim I got for what I consider, a handful of fairly decent films. And then when you consider that somebody like Orson Welles, who made perhaps the greatest American film ever, died broke, basically. I look back on it and I think I was very lucky.
Yeah, you made some films, though, that had an enormous box office appeal and great success. And I was surprised in reading your memoir to find out how depressed you were after The French Connection won the Academy Award, in large part because, you talk about your demons, but maybe you just felt you really didn't deserve the Oscar.
I felt that exactly. I thought it was too soon. I thought of The French Connection as a kind of very good B picture. I thought it would be considered, above standard B film. And then it got all this acclaim, which is in the hands of the movie god. There's nothing you can do about that. And I frankly don't believe in the Academy Awards, even though I've won them and been nominated, and I produced the show one year. But films are not in competition with one another. It's not a foot race. It's not a tennis match. It's not a boxing match. As filmmakers, we're not in competition with other filmmakers. So to me, it's a gigantic self-promotion, the greatest any industry has ever devised for itself.
It's also moments of glory, and it does more than promote. It also makes, you may have been depressed, but you talk about, for example, when you got the Oscar and all these things were, you talk about them early on in your memoir as fireflies, the moments in your life were kind of floating illuminatingly through your mind as you went up to get the Oscar. And, those are moments that you can't, from a filmmaker standpoint, from an Oscar recipient standpoint, have no equal, do they?
I have no regrets, believe me. I just have a kind of realistic perspective on it. There is no best. It's all subjective. If five actors played Hamlet, how would you know who was the best? You might like this guy or that guy. If five actresses played the same role, who would be the best?
Olivier.
Laurence Olivier? Yes, for those who've seen him, but I don't know. As time goes by, I think Olivier was a great technical actor. I didn't get the sense of deep emotional feeling from Olivier's performances. No doubt he's a great actor, though. But it's subjective. I think that as a film actor, Marlon Brando cut a far wider swath than Olivier.
Sorry, Wider Swath makes me think of Brando Moore in his later years, I suppose. Talk about,
well, but a performance.
You're talking about his acting performance.
I'm talking about, yeah.
Joyce Carol Oates, actually, not a name drop, but just sent me a poem that she wrote about Marlon Brando that's going to be in a British publication, and it is brutal. I mean, he was, you know, from her standpoint, a misogynistic and unredeemable character. But
how well did she know him, though?
Well, I mean, I don't know. That's a good question.
These things spread around. So, and I've been called misogynistic because of my most recent film, Killer Joe. I don't believe that I am.
You've been called homophobic because of Cruising, too, right?
I have been called homophobic, and I don't consider myself that in any way. I'm a filmmaker with a curiosity about a number of things, a number of worlds that were unfamiliar to me and would remain unfamiliar if I didn't explore them as a filmmaker.
Is part of the reason that you, not necessarily derogate, but slough off something like The French Connection as a great commercial hit and a B-movie, perhaps a desire more to get an artistic recognition or acclaim, which, by the way, you've gotten more recently with the operas you've directed. That's, in many people's minds, maybe a higher art than a film that you are talking about in a different category.
I don't feel that way, Michael. There are a number of films that I think of as art, but I don't, and perhaps high art, but film is too young a medium to discuss in terms of the great art of music and painting, for example. I don't think we'll know what the great films were for maybe 1,000 years.
But when you went to do The Birthday Party, you were doing a play that still hadn't quite caught the imagination. It was still considered kind of an outlying play at best. But Pinter, you know, is one of the great playwrights of the 20th century. You were doing something that you felt perhaps more connected to because it was higher level?
No, it just moved me. I first saw it in San Francisco at the Actors Workshop that was run by two guys I'm sure met you and many of your audience will remember, Blau and Irving. And I first saw The Birthday Party on my first visit to San Francisco in the early 60s.
62,
when I came here and my film, my first film, won the Golden Gate Award here. And I saw The Birthday Party, and it just knocked me out. I didn't think of it as high art. It was just very powerful experience that I certainly hadn't had at that time from a play, and rarely since.
Talking with film director and filmmaker Billy Friedkin, whose new memoir is called The Friedkin Connection. Let's talk a little bit about that film that brought you to San Francisco. It was about a young African-American in Chicago on death row, and even that film, which got tremendous laudatory and plaudits beyond your wildest dreams. I'm reading your memoir, and you're going back and obviously seeing these films that you made in your youth, and you're pretty critical of it.
I don't think it's a well-made film, but it was a great story. It was this African-American man was found guilty of the daylight robbery and murder of a guard at the Libby McNeil Libby Company in the Chicago stockyards. Only 4 men, masked men, were seen at the scene of the crime. A 5th man, Paul Crump, was implicated by the other 4 as the trigger man. The other 4 guys got out of prison, get out of jail free card. Crump alone was sentenced to die in the electric chair. And he had been in for several years when I accidentally heard about his case. I was a director in live television then. I'd never made a film. But I wanted to make this film as a kind of court of last resort after I met Mr. Crump and believed not only that he was rehabilitated from the time he had come in to prison and to death row, but I believed that he was framed because in those days it was the habit of the Chicago Police Department, if there was a crime involving African Americans, they would go into the community and round up the usual suspects and beat the hell out of them and get a confession. And this is what happened to him. My film was instrumental in getting him pardoned by Governor Kerner at the time to life in prison without possibility of parole. And I think he did another 30 or so years and then was eventually paroled. But he couldn't make it on the outside by then.
It's still an important issue to you? Because I'm thinking about people like Scott Turow who have, given a lot of resources in their own stamp of involvement to, say, the Innocence Project and, mm-hmm. you know, DNA has changed everything. And Illinois, in fact, now no longer, in fact, has executions.
I witnessed what I believe is the last man to die in the electric chair. That's in my book. He was a guy named Vincent Chiucci. And I remember his execution in vivid graphic detail as though it happened yesterday. And I describe it in detail. You know, the state's power and ability to kill somebody in cold blood. Now, I think we've all felt an impulse at one time or another to kill. I believe that's true.
You certainly did. You write about it.
Yeah, well,
the guy who was bullying you in
Hebrew school.
Yeah.
But how serious that impulse is, varies, fortunately. And I turned my radical impulses toward my exploration of these emotions in filmmaking.
You sublimated to your great success, yes.
Oh, I'm happier about it, too. But I got into this business accidentally, as you know, from reading my book.
Actually, it's a wonderful story. You were called stupid as a result, but it happened to be, whether it was stupid or not, getting an address wrong turned out to be your good fortune. Talk to them. I mean, it's a good story.
Well, I graduated high school, and I had no direction. I had no idea what I wanted to do, except I didn't want to be in a classroom for another 20 minutes. There was an ad in a local newspaper in Chicago advertising for young men, specifically young men, not women, to start at an entry-level job at a television station and work your way up into becoming a television director, because there were no schools. You would either be an usher or work in the mailroom. So I went down to the mailroom of WGN Television, which is a big, well-known, powerful signal, great television station. I went on a Saturday to the mailroom, and the guy who ran it was a guy named Ray Domalski. And he was there on Saturday, and he said, what are you doing here, kid? And I said, well, I'm applying for this job. He said, show me the ad. And I looked at, I gave him the ad that I had answered, and he said, well, tell me about yourself. There was very little to tell, Michael. But I told him what I could, and he said after maybe a few minutes, he said, well, you seem like a nice kid, so here's what you do. Come in on Monday, $33 a week, you work 6 days, and that's it. And I said, oh, well, thank you, sir. And as I was about to leave, he said, by the way, kid, are you stupid? And I said, excuse me? He said, take a look at the address on that ad you just showed me. What is it? And I looked at it, and it said 446 North Michigan Avenue. He said, kid, this is 441 North Michigan. We're across the street. The ad was from WBBM Television, CBS. We're WGN. You came to the wrong place, but you got hired anyway.
Thus, a great career was born. We're talking to Billy Friedkin, and in fact, who would have thought then, a kid who got in trouble in Goldblatt's department store with a zip gun, that you would go on to make movies like The Exorcist, which, by the way, there's a lot about Blatty in your book. I mean, you talk about mentors, like going back to that earlier, you talk about Coughlin.
Francis Coughlin.
And you talk about the influence and your admiration for Francis Ford Coppola and a number of people through the years who you've had associations with, as well as people who, I don't think, you say you weren't doing sour grapes, but you know, there are people like Pacino who come across very badly in terms of your associations with them. But I want to get you down here to talk about making of The Exorcist, because it's almost like you're writing a biography of Blatty. You two guys must have really bonded.
Blatty's history is very interesting. Again, he was an undergraduate at Georgetown in 1949 when The Exorcist case appeared on the front pages of the Washington Post, a three-page story that was written by a reporter then called Bill Brinkley, who later became a successful novelist. He wrote Don't Go Near the Water. But Blatty was at Georgetown, and his religious instructor, a guy named Father Eugene Gallagher, came in talking about this possible case of demonic possession that happened in that area, It actually occurred in Silver Spring, Maryland. And Blatty and the other religious students felt that if this was true, it would be religious nirvana, because it was only the third case in the 20th century in the United States that the Catholic Church gave its approval to perform an exorcism. And Blatty tried to find out more details about it. It was a 14-year-old boy, not a 12-year-old girl. He couldn't get any more details because the church is very closed-mouthed about these things to protect the victim. This was a 14-year-old boy who had all of the symptoms that are in the novel and the screenplay and more. And I saw the diaries of the not only the priests who were involved with this case, but the doctors, the nurses, the patients who were at Alexian Brothers Hospital in St. Louis, where this exorcism was performed in 1949. I have read their diaries, which were given to me after an early evening's drinking bout with Father Robert Henley, who was the president of Georgetown. And so I made the film believing in the veracity of these events. Now, Blatty had to change the gender of the boy to a 12-year-old girl at the request of the Catholic diocese in Washington. But that young man, who was the victim in 49, he retired about 6 or 7 years ago from a long career at NASA, and he has no memory of what happened to him when he was 14. And Blatty gave me his wonderful novel to direct before even The French Connection had come out.
He also gave you a screenplay, which you had to tell him just didn't work at all.
I didn't care for the original screenplay, and we started again from scratch and went back to the book.
And you did Holy Communion, I read in your memoir, too.
Yes, I didn't know.
It can't hurt.
Well, I didn't know the implications of it. And when Blatty heard that I had taken communion, because I'm not Catholic, he called the priest who gave me communion, and Bill said, gee, I'm terribly sorry this happened. And the priest said, well, it can't hurt him, you know. So, but I'm not Catholic, but I very much believe in that story and in the mystery of faith, which is what it's about.
And you yourself were painted as the devil in Germany. That's quite
a story, too.
Oh. Der Spiegel did a story on you, and you were actually pretty angry about it. You wanted to sue him, didn't you?
Yes, but you can't in Germany because the press can say anything at all about you. And when I went to Germany to do interviews before The Exorcist had opened, I had a request from a newspaper called Die Bild Zeitung, and it was a very high profile.
I know that. They actually, that newspaper did a piece on me.
The Bild Zeitung?
Yeah.
And they had big readership, and the reporter who requested the interview said, look, I know Mr. Friedkin's getting in late tonight, but I'll stay here, and I'm coming with a photographer, and we'll hold the front page to do this story. Now, I was dead tired. But the Warner Brothers representative said, oh, you got to do this. And they'll also put the film on the cover of Der Spiegel magazine, which was owned by Axel Springer, who also owned the Bild Zeitung. And so I reluctantly agreed to do it. And the guy who interviewed me was terrific. He was like the Michael Krasny of Germany. And he was a really fine interviewer. And the photographer went around my suite snapping pictures. And indeed, the next morning, a picture appeared, not of me, but of the bed in the bedroom of my hotel suite. And the headline in German was, "This is the bed where the devil sleeps." And then it talked about me as the man who was bringing evil to Germany, which I felt was very ironic.
Well, here's a clip from The Exorcist we thought we'd dig up for you. In 1973 film, the family is called a doctor to the house to check on their little girl who appears to be possessed. And when the scene starts, you hear a girl screaming in the background.
Dr. Klein.
Yes, I'm Dr. Klein. This is Dr. Tanny.
How do you do?
Sharon, things have gotten worse since I phoned you. I think you better go upstairs.
Is she having spasms again?
Yeah, but they've gotten violent.
Did you give her the medication I gave you?
Yes.
What was that? Tarzy. Well, that was Ritalin.
doctors.
Mother, please! Dr. Taylor. Please, Mother,
what is it? What's happening?
It stop! It's burning! It's burning!
Do something, Mother. Doctor, please help her!
Keep away! The sow is mine!
Now that's the devil's voice. Not Billy Friedkin's. Let's not confuse them. That's a scene from the 1973 film directed by William Friedkin, The Exorcist, and that film scared the hell out of everybody. But you didn't like it being called a horror film, did you?
I understand that it is considered a horror film, but Bill Blatty, who wrote it, and I, we never talked about making a horror film or horror effects. We knew that the film would be disturbing. The story is disturbing. You can hear it without seeing it, how chilling it is, just the clip you played. So we knew that it would disturb people. But we both set out to make a film about the mystery of faith. And that's it. Now, I understand that everyone considers it a horror film, and fine. At least this is the 40th year, and the film is going to be re-released again in theaters this year in a new digital version, and the first screening will be on October 30th at the Smithsonian Institute.
Well, congratulations on that anniversary and that event. And I must tell you that in reading your memoir about The Exorcist, I was struck by the story about, well, Mercedes McCambridge, who did the voice, mm-hmm. Linda Blair, and also one of those who was a stand-in for Linda Blair, because both of them were angry that they didn't get credits. And the way you tell the story, Mercedes McCambridge had said initially, I don't want to have a credit.
I swear before God, Michael, that Mercedes McCambridge, who I sought out and hired to do this demon voice because I remembered her from dramatic radio in the 40s and 50s, a great voice that was kind of neutral. It was neither male nor female, and it came to me as an inspiration. And when I went to her, she agreed to do it, but she said, look, I insist that I not get any credit. She said, because for this film to work, you don't want people thinking that somebody dubbed this voice. You want them to think that this is the voice of a demon in the little girl.
And she was Catholic, of course, too.
She had been raised Catholic and was very much a Catholic. And I thought that her desire not to have screen credit was because of that, that she didn't really want, you know, to, if the film was denounced by the church, to be a part of it. But then when the film opened, became a huge success, she asked for screen credit, which we immediately gave to her. There were only 26 prints, so we just remade the last reel of 26 prints and happily put her credit up there. But she then gave some interviews where she said that she was as much responsible for the performance as Linda.
Talking with William Friedkin, and listeners, we'd like to hear from you. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions or comments for a famed filmmaker who's here with us, you can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. You can also join the conversation on our website and our Facebook page, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. And here's Exorcist music. That is music again from The Exorcist. Academy Award-winning filmmaker William Friedkin reached the Hollywood stratosphere in the 1970s with groundbreaking films such as The French Connection and The Exorcist, and that success was not to last. As he writes in his new memoir, I was at the edge of a cliff and my demons were standing by, waiting to push me off. Today he's directing films, including 2011's well-received Killer Joe, and he's even developed a second career as an opera director, and is with us in studio to discuss his new memoir, The Friedkin Connection. He'll be signing books at Book Passage at the Ferry Building at 6 p.m. this evening, and he'll also be signing books before a screening of To Live and Die in L.A. at the New People Cinema, 8 p.m., followed by questions and answers. And he's here to answer any questions you may have. In fact, you may want to ask him about filmmaking, because there's a good deal I think on page 188 in his memoir, he writes about three important things in making a film. It's a little bit of a guidebook in terms of just what you do behind the camera and how you become a dictator when you're editing. And there's all that kind of inside information that's important for many people who want to have a life in film of some kind or another. Let me tell you, by the way, that you can join us by calling us at our toll-free number 866-733-6786 or join the conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page or email us, forum@kqed.org. One thing I learned from your book that I never would have imagined, Sonny Bono is a genius.
In my opinion, he was. He didn't read a note of music. It was all as though dictated to him. And he used to go into the studio, and he would hear a track in his head, and he would hum the parts to the various musicians. He'd say, strings, play like this, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he'd hum a melody. Then he'd tell the drums, he'd give the drums a tempo, and he'd give the other instruments parts to play. And then there was no conductor. He'd go into the control room, say, okay, guys, hit it. And he would start to sculpt the music track. Drums, play a little softer. Strings, change that melody. Go up a little higher at the end. He'd spend a week creating a track. And then he would sit down with somebody's empty lunch bag and write a lyric at that point. Lyrics like I Got You, Babe, and The Beat Goes On, and songs that were really big at that time. After he'd get the track and the lyrics, he would call Cher, send a car for her, and teach her how to sing the song. And she has always said that when she was singing, she thought she was imitating Sonny. And he would put these tracks together as though by inspiration alone and on the spot. And I was at so many of his sessions. They were at a studio called Gold Star in Santa Monica in Los Angeles. And that's where the Wall of Sound was created.
The Phil Spector Wall of Sound. Yeah.
Phil Spector. And Sonny was a gopher for Phil Spector. That's how he got started.
And you were trying to make a film with him that was made and tanked, essentially. Yeah?
No, it didn't do bad. We made the film for $800,000, and the producer sold it for $1.2 million. To Columbia Pictures at the time. And then, you know, it made a tidy little profit at the time. It wasn't a huge hit.
I know you're asked this question a lot, but what do you advise aspiring young filmmakers, particularly in light of the fact that you, as you said, couldn't stand school? I don't know if you have regrets about not going to college. I know your wife's been on the
regions.
No
regrets.
No regrets at all?
No.
So what do you tell an aspiring young filmmaker, since you have said many times in this memoir in different ways you felt you got lucky, really, in some ways?
You do need ambition and luck and the grace of God, in my opinion.
This is coming from an agnostic, right? The grace of God.
I'm an agnostic, but the way I define an agnostic is a person who believes that the power of God and the soul are unknowable. I don't deny the existence of God or the soul. I mean, who knows? We don't know anything. We don't know how we got here. We don't know where we're going. We don't know how we're going to leave this mortal coil. We come here with no knowledge. And as Hamlet said to his friend Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio. That's what I feel. I can't deny anyone's belief. But I do believe that you need luck, the grace of God, and ambition. And I have left out talent. Because there are a lot of people who have the first three that have become very successful, and I see some of the films and I don't see the talent.
Let's hear from some of our callers, and let's begin with a caller. Steve, good morning.
Hi, Michael. How are you? Mr. Friedkin. Love your movies. Great to speak with you. Can't wait to read your book. Listen, I have one observation. I saw The Exorcist re-released in theaters a couple of years ago, and I was appalled to find that young people were laughing at the film, at the horrific scenes. And I've asked other people who've sat through, you know, screenings of it, too, recently, and they are laughing. And I'm finding, like, is that an indictment of young people today? I just want to
It's a good question, Steve. Thanks for your kind comments. No, people need a kind of release from a situation in which they feel uncomfortable. I have found that the laughter that occurs in The Exorcist is a normal reaction to something that becomes so intense that your instinctive reaction is to say, ha, well, that's not going to get to me, and that's ridiculous. But people continue in large numbers to see The Exorcist. For one reason you would see a film like The Exorcist is because you're sitting in the dark. You are with somebody, you might be alone, but you know that the dark is safe. We call it a safe darkness because you know that when the movie is over, you can get up and leave the theater, and this hasn't happened to you, but you've witnessed it happening to characters on the screen. And sometimes, I've seen this happen in Jaws, in Psycho, in some of the most terrifying films, people will laugh. It is a common and a normal reaction.
Speaking of Jaws, I discovered that Spielberg was supposed to maybe be the director of The Exorcist at one time.
I had never heard that. No, yeah. Cruising.
I meant Cruising, yeah.
Yeah, Spielberg was originally attached to direct Cruising, and they couldn't set it up.
And you mentioned Hitchcock. There's a wonderful story in your book about you meeting Hitchcock for the first time. And he wanted to know why you didn't, or he actually told you, I guess, imperiously, you're supposed to wear a tie with me?
Well, I admire Hitchcock perhaps as much or more than any other filmmaker, alive or dead. And I directed the last Hitchcock Hour that was made. It was the first thing I did in a studio. Everything else I had done was a documentary or a live TV show.
Now, take me back. Was this this was after David Wolper or before you signed on?
I was still at Wolper, and Norman Lloyd, who was the producer of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, saw some of my documentaries, and he asked for a meeting with me. And I met with him, and he told me that the Paul Crump documentary about the guy on death row had more suspense than anything they had done on the Hitchcock Hour in the last season, the ninth season. So he hired me to do the last show. And it was a five-day shoot for about 48 minutes of film. And Hitchcock would only come in one day a week. And he'd read his introductions off what we call an idiot card, you know, where they were all written down next to the camera, and he'd say, good evening. And then he'd go into these very well-written intros. And he came in on a Thursday, and there was he came in like the President of the United States. He had eight guys in black suits around him, and they moved like a gigantic wave in my direction. And I was introduced to Mr. Hitchcock. And he held out his hand as though I was supposed to kiss it. And I took his hand, and it was pretty clammy. And I said, well, it's an honor to meet you, sir. And he said, Mr. Friedkin, usually our directors wear ties. And I thought he was putting me on. So I said, well, I guess I left it at home in my rush to get. And by the time I finished my sentence, he was gone. And then about 4 or 5 years later, I hadn't seen him for 4 or 5 years. It was the evening of the Directors Guild Awards at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. And I had just won the Directors Guild Award, a beautiful gold plate. And I see sitting below me, there was a table, you know, a bunch of tables. And people had dinner and then they had the awards. At the table below me was Hitchcock and his family and his agents. And instead of going backstage after I made my acceptance speech, I was wearing a rented tuxedo and one of those snap-on bow ties. And I walked down 3 steps to where Mr. Hitchcock was sitting, and I snapped my tie at him, and I said, how do you like the tie now, Hitch? And he sort of stared at me. He didn't remember, but I did.
How did you think Hopkins did? Did you see him performing Hitchcock in that recently?
I didn't care for it.
No,
didn't. I'm sorry. I just didn't care for it, and I didn't see Hitchcock there.
I think we got another caller. Rex, good morning.
Yes, how are you? I had one question, but to listen to Mr. Friedkin speak is, well, both of you guys, actually, is just a treat. Mr. Friedkin, your films are brilliant. I had one question originally about how you chose your music. I'm a drummer. I've been a jazz drummer all my life, and always loved your selection for your music. Tubular Bells was the emphasis, and of course, Wang Chung in Live and Die in L.A., which to me is a just an amazing film. I love the end and the way the truck drives up and the hero dies at the end. And we never see that actor for years again until CSI. So just everything about you is so mysterious. And I must say, sir, you sound over the radio like Jack Lemmon. I don't know if Mr. Lemmon is from Chicago, but my question really, without babbling too much, is do you have any influence in selecting the music for your films?
Totally. Thank you for that great question. Please call me Billy or Bill, not Mr. Friedkin. But I appreciate the question. The music usually finds me. I hear somebody. I heard Tangerine Dream playing in an abandoned church in the Black Forest in Germany. There were no lights in the church, just the lights of their electronic instruments. And they played these amazing, long, sinuous chords that I'd never heard before. And I asked them to do a score for a film that I hadn't even decided I was going to do yet. There was no script, but I told them, when I had a script, I would send it to them and talk to them about the film. And I wanted them to just write their impressions of what I told them without seeing the film. And that's what they did. I wanted to be inspired by the music, not have the music just score the film. I did that with Wang Chung. Same thing. The music for The Exorcist is mostly contemporary, at that time, classical music. It was serial. I wanted the music to feel like a cold hand on the back of your neck. I didn't want melodic music. I wanted textures. And so I personally chose some compositions by some household names like Krzysztof Penderecki, Hans Werner Henze, George Crumb, Anton Webern, and I mixed sections of their music together, and that's the score. And then I found Tubular Bells by accident and used it three times in the film.
Early on in the book, you talk about not only the importance of Citizen Kane in your consciousness and growing up and everything, but Stravinsky's Rites of Spring.
One night after I was signing off the television station in Chicago, I usually used to listen to the jazz station. But I somehow or other pushed the wrong button on my 1960 Chrysler Valiant on the outer drive in Chicago, and I heard these otherworldly sounds, and I pulled over, and I listened to this piece of music through, and it had a profound effect on my life. And that was, I didn't know what it was until the announcer at the end said, Le Sacre du Printemps, The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky, written in 1913 for a ballet by Serge Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. And I went out and bought that recording. I actually saw Stravinsky conduct it in Chicago many years later.
And little did you know you'd be directing opera.
I didn't know. I didn't know at all. That was accidental, too.
How did you get into opera directing?
Well, Zubin Mehta is a good friend of mine. And those of you who don't know Zubin Mehta can turn the radio off right now because he's one of the great conductors of our time. He and I are good friends socially, and we would have dinner with our wives. And one evening, we used to talk about politics and current events, music and movies. One night he said to me out of the blue, why don't you do an opera with me? And I said, Zubin, I've never seen an opera. He said, no, but we've talked about opera music. Surely you must. I said, I've listened to opera music, but I've never seen one stage. He said, no, you'd be very good. And he went out of the room. We were at his house. He came back with his diary, which had his bookings for 7 years. And he said, what would you do if you had the chance? And in order to put him off, because I knew he was talking about doing this in Florence, where he's the permanent conductor of the opera, they hate German music in Florence, even good German music. And this, I chose Alban Berg's Wozzeck. I said I would do one of the two Berg operas, which are Lulu and Wozzeck. And I thought he would say, well, that's out of the question. But he leafed through his diary and he said, okay, in 2 years, I'll do Wozzeck with you at the Maggio Musicale in Florence if you commit to it now. And I thought, oh, my God, I wouldn't even know how to begin this. And my wife said, oh, go ahead, it'll be fun. And so I committed to it, and I studied the opera, and by the time I got to Florence, I had a concept. And everything I've done since has come as a result of that.
And we should mention, I mean, you were talking before about the important elements of success. With you, a lot of it is studying. I mean, doing the research. You're pretty, how shall we say, maybe anal retentive about doing thorough research?
I would rather put it, Michael, as I steep myself in the material. I did, when I did the French Connection, I rode around with those two detectives for 6 months. And the film was made up of my experiences with them and how they operated in the street and what they did. And so, and I studied the libretto and the music of Wozzeck for a year. I took German lessons in order to be able to find an approach.
This is ambition. And we're going to hear a cut from The French Connection. Here's a clip from that film made in 1973.
71.
Excuse me, 71. In this scene, Popeye, played by Gene Hackman, and his partner Cloudy, played by Roy Scheider, are roughing up a suspect for information.
You going to tell us who your man is?
When's the last time you picked your feet, Willie?
Who's your connection, Willie? What's his name?
What?
Answer him! No, no, man, no! Hey, no.
Is it Joe the Barber?
What?
Joe the Barber, right?
No.
That's who it is, isn't it?
Now, don't give us any What's Joe's last name?
I don't know, man. Give it. Give it. Yeah, all I know is there's a 125th Street, man, about the barbershop.
What side of the street do you live on? North or south? North or south?
I don't know what you're talking about, man. I don't know.
No, I'm asking south. You what side of the street he lives on.
Hey, Ed, when was the last time you picked your feet? Huh?
Yeah, what's he talking about?
I got a man in Poughkeepsie who wants to talk to you. You ever been to Poughkeepsie? Huh? Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie?
Hey, man, come on, give me a break.
Hey,
hey,
come
what
on,
you
come
talking
on, say
about?
It. Let me hear you say it. Come on. Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? You've been to Poughkeepsie, haven't you?
I want to hear it!
Come on!
Yes, I've...
You've been there, right?
Yeah.
You sat on the edge of the bed, didn't you? You took off your shoes, put your finger between your toes, and picked your feet, didn't you? Now say it!
Yes!
All right. You put a shoe on my partner. You know what that means? Damn it! All winter long, I gotta listen to him gripe about his bowling scores. Now, I'm gonna bust your ass for those three bags, and I'm gonna nail you for picking your feet in Poughkeepsie.
A clip from the 1971 film by Billy Friedkin. The French Connection, couldn't help thinking about McCann and Goldberg and the birthday party, but also that's the kind of stuff you might have heard out on the streets when you were with those guys, but also even going back to Paul Crump, the African-American, and the way he was roughed up and stuff.
Well, the Poughkeepsie routine was something that the real cop played by Gene Hackman, his name was Eddie Egan. He used to do that with his partner, Sonny Grasso. Grasso would ask the suspect something that they knew he had just done, but didn't want to confess to. Egan would ask the guy a question that was purely surrealistic. The guy didn't know what he was talking about, but so he couldn't answer that. But he thought that what if he answered what they really wanted to know from him, he would be in big trouble. So he would instead confess to picking his feet in Poughkeepsie. And Egan used to do that routine because he knew that many of the suspects had never heard of Poughkeepsie, couldn't pronounce it, didn't know what happened there, but would rather talk about that than what they were after him for.
It's a funny scene.
It's very Pinteresque, you're right.
Yeah, it is. And
I took it down exactly as they did it, and that's how it's done in the film, without explanation.
You also write about Hackman having some serious reserve about the racism and mm-hmm. not wanting to do that character, really.
When I introduced Gene to Egan, he wasn't turned on by him. He didn't see the dramatic possibilities at the time, but he wanted to do the film. But he thought Egan was a racist, and I didn't. That's the way a cop had to operate in the streets in certain parts of New York, and other cities at that time.
Bring another call on, and Art, you're with us. Good morning, Art.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much, Mr. Krasny and Bill, or Billy, and Mr.
Sure.
Friedkin. I want to mention a film that you did that I rented. I came across it called Bug.
Mm-hmm.
You did that, in fact. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, what a gripping psychological piece of filmmaking that was. I understand that was your reentry into directing after 10 years of silence, so to speak.
Not quite. No, I had done some operas in between that, and I had kind of lost interest in contemporary American filmmaking until I found the work of Tracy Letts, who wrote Bug, and he also wrote Killer Joe. And he and I were on the same wavelength. We had the same kind of worldview, and that brought me back to wanting to make films again.
Talk about feeling the way you did about American filmmaking. You come across, I don't mean this in any way, in any derogatory way, but as a Francophile when it comes to filmmaking and film criticism.
Well, not anymore. I don't even know who's making films in Europe anymore.
You got to read our local film reviewer, Mick LaSalle, who's done really a good book.
He's great.
French filmmaking.
No, yeah. Mick LaSalle is a wonderful reviewer and writer about film. But I grew up on the films of Jean-Luc Godard, Alain René, H.G. Clouzot, Jean-Pierre Melville, and many other European filmmakers. I don't know who they are today. But I couldn't wait for the next film in the 60s from France or Italy or Japan from people like Kurosawa and Imamura.
We went to see him at a film theater called The Surf, and we had one of this identical name here in San Francisco that showed all those same foreign filmmakers. The Surf.
Yes, and now the real cinematheque of world film is the DVD and the Blu-ray, specifically by companies like Criterion and others who have brought out wonderful editions of the great classics of world cinema.
Our guest is Billy Friedkin. His new memoir is called The Friedkin Connection, and he won the Academy Award for Best Director for the 1971 film The French Connection. Let me go to some of your emails here and website comments. Genevieve writes on our website, I've witnessed and experienced the laughing response to The Exorcist. I first saw the film when I was 9 when it appeared on network TV. It terrified me, causing me significant loss of sleep for several days. I think such laughter is indeed an attempt, one typical perhaps of adolescents, maybe adolescent males trying to be tough, to distance or protect oneself from the horror of what's happening on screen. I've seen it countless times since then and can never imagine laughing at any of it again. Just hearing the scene a moment ago was horrifying.
Genevieve, you put it better than I did.
There's a listener named Sa who writes, I just finished his memoir. It looks like his biggest career mistake came during casting of The Sorcerer. Only if he had not been stubborn and found a location in the United States or had agreed to put Ally McGraw in the film someplace, he would have had Steve McQueen and the movie could have been another hit. It's a shame because I would have loved seeing Steve in another action movie and it will never be. Well, you do admit to some pretty serious mistakes, to wit... I mean, Star Wars, for one, passing on a letter from Prince, the performer. I mean,
Jean-Paul Basquiat,
the Haitian artist. Yeah. There's another listener, Lee, who says, the car chase scenes in To Live and Die in L.A. and The French Connection are some of the greatest caught on film. Can the director talk about how he approached creating those visceral, exciting, and dangerous action sequences? And they've been,
yes.
By the way, the car scenes have been copying you decades since. For international purposes, I think they put in car scenes that last interminably in movies nowadays, but French Connection still stands out as one of the best.
Let me talk to you a little bit about how you do those scenes. First, you have to envision them in your mind's eye before you make one shot. And I do that, and I see the whole scene in my head, but then you make it one shot at a time, and I compare it very closely to knitting. If you've ever knitted and you're knitting a sweater, you see the pattern or you have a copy of the pattern or it's in your mind's eye, but you do it one stitch at a time. That's how you film a chase. Each individual shot doesn't look that dangerous. It's how they're combined and with the sound. But let me say this. The greatest chase scenes I've ever seen were made by Buster Keaton at the turn of the 20th century. If I had seen any of those scenes before I set out to make a chase, I would not have tried to do a chase. The Keaton chases, to me, are astounding, and they've all been remastered now so you could see them. But fortunately, I saw them after I had made three chases myself.
Time for another call. Neil, that's you. Join us.
Yeah, I'd like to find out what projects got away from you. I understand you were offered The Godfather. And
no, that's not true.
Oh, you weren't?
No, but I was offered MASH, and I read the script and didn't care for it. There were many things.
What did you really want to do that you got away from you?
Nothing. There was everything that I turned down, I wasn't interested in. At one point, I got a phone call from the producer of Raging Bull, who told me that was in production and Mr. Scorsese didn't know what the hell he was doing, and he asked if I would replace him. And I thanked him very much and hung up the phone.
It's funny because when I interviewed many years ago Isabel Rossellini, she told me that Mr. Scorsese, who supposedly didn't know what the hell he was doing, had showed her, his then wife, some film he had done. And he said, I'm not going to use it. And the reason is, it's perfect.
Yeah. Well, he had some problems with the producers. And yes, I was offered to take over that film, which I it didn't take me 2 seconds to consider it and refuse it.
Billy Friedkin, film director, producer, screenwriter, new book, The Friedkin Collection, a memoir.
Connection. Thank you, Michael.
Friedman Connection.
The Friedkin Connection, Michael.
The Friedkin Connection. Man has to correct me because I'm having Freudian slips here. The Friedkin Connection.
I have that effect on people.
Yes, you do. It's an exorcist effect. Academy Award for Best Director, 1971 film, The French Connection. Thank heavens your mother cried, because if she hadn't cried when you did that thing, maybe this career never unfolded.
When I robbed a grocery, a department store, I didn't know right from wrong. It was my mother's tears that turned me away from a life of crime.
It's a moving story in itself. He'll be at Signing Books of Book Passage, Ferry Building, 6 p.m., and also a screening to Live and Die in L.A. at the New People Cinema, 8 p.m. Thank you so much for being
Thank
with
you,
us.
Thank you, Michael. Great pleasure.
For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.